And now it's time for the Wild Side News with your host, Sydney Wildsmith.
It's official. As of right now, the debate over whether or not we can expect changes in our climate in the years ahead is over. And the winner is, you guessed it, the global warming climate change advocates. So as these changes will take years to develop, we have time to relax a little and enjoy our world. And that's what we're doing as we travel around the country, hearing what's happening right now in our state parks. And we bring you up to date as we announce the weekly Earth Summit, when your voice of the Earth continues here on the Wild Side News.
Welcome back to the Wild Side News. And now, Sydney Wildsmith.
It's taken years to get people to accept it that global warming is happening. But with whole nations pushing for global cap and trade systems, our media filled with ads by every major corporation touting their commitment to a cleaner, greener environment, with Academy Awards going to mainstream movies, and even China talking about a need to limit their greenhouse gas emissions, we've won the debate. Now it's time for us to begin to work together around the world to do things right. It is, quite frankly, possibly one of the most significant single benefits from globalization. Who knows? Maybe the world might begin to see the excitement of creating a world where we work together. We won. And now that we've won, it's important to realize that many of these changes will take years to materialize. Although I can see the ocean shoreline from my studio, people are out there enjoying the ocean. No one's running in terror. I don't see oceanside homes condemned as unsafe to live in. If we do things right, we can help to undo what we've already done wrong. So, we do have time to enjoy this earth, and that's what we're going to do today. It's spring in the Northern Hemisphere, a time of life and birth and exuberance. And we're going to travel from one side of the country to another to hear just what is happening in the forests and the bayous and prairies as told to us by naturalists in our state parks from Minnesota, South Carolina, Wyoming, and more. That's coming up in segments 2 and 3. And following today's news, we're just 1 week away from a major new format for the Wild Side News, as next week we launch the Weekly Earth Summit. You'll find out why we keep talking about the most important 10 minutes on Earth. It's all coming up following the week's news. So now the news. Former UN Secretary Kofi Annan said last Friday that topping the list of issues confronting the international community are restoring the environment and dealing with climate change. Mr. Annan stated, "If we do not get the climate under control, if we do not confront the challenges of the environment, every other effort we are making can be washed aside." That pretty much makes the case that we've won our point. Those mystical narwhals, the deep-diving Arctic whales famous for the male's long spiral tusk, are being harnessed with radio telemetry recording devices in order to track their movements and record conditions in their northern habitats. The narwhals spend much of their time diving to depths of over a mile into the frigid Arctic seas, hunting for the Greenland halibut, a deep-water flatfish that lives on the floor of Baffin Bay. Of the 100,000 narwhals estimated to exist, 50 to 70,000 live in the Baffin Bay area. Researchers plan to outfit 10 narwhals with the telemetric monitors in hopes of learning much more about the habits of the narwhal and the conditions of this remote area that lies in the midst of one area on Earth where the effects of climate change are already being felt in a most dramatic way. Last week, we reported on the Amur leopard of Russia's far north. The Amur leopard is considered one of the most endangered animals on Earth, with estimates of between 25 and 34 living in the wild. This week, That number was reduced by one as hunters shot and clubbed a female Amur leopard to death. This brings the number of females down to six, as males tend to be born in greater numbers during times of severe population stress. The Amur leopard is critically endangered due to a lack of effective protections by the Russian government and the disappearance of habitat due to the encroachment of human populations. Scientists are at it again, trying to prove very complex animal behaviors from a purely scientific perspective. Scientists announced that they had uncovered proof to dispute a commonly held belief that chimpanzees are as cooperative as they are, and they are one of the most cooperative animals along with humans, in an effort to protect and strengthen their bloodline. Researchers for years have believed that male chimpanzees associate and cooperate more with blood-related males, such as sibling brothers, and that certainly is the case. But after conducting genetic analysis of fecal samples, scientists have concluded that yes, chimps do tend to cooperate with their sibling males, but also find plenty of opportunity to cooperate with males outside their bloodlines. Scientists conclude, once and for all, that cooperation is not the exclusive domain of the human species. They have now proved conclusively that animals, besides humans, do cooperate. And just about the time you think scientists have given us something we can feel confident about, other scientists announce that we'd better start wondering once again if there is life on other planets, as they have discovered a planet that is enough like our own Earth to raise some serious speculation about whether or not life does exist beyond our earthly realm. Key commonalities include a similar size, although you would weigh more there, but most importantly, the climate appears to be fairly generally hospitable for life as we know it on Earth. Unlike Earth, the planet circles its sun every 13 days, compared to our 365 days. You'd get much older faster. At this time, not enough is known about this new discovery to decide if perhaps we should start to consider this new planet in our long-term sustainability plans for people on planet Earth. And that's the news. For weeks, we've been talking about a new feature coming to the Wildside News, the weekly Earth Summit. Well, we're about to make some program changes to the Wildside News in order to bring the most timely and significant voices around the world to you each week. Beginning with our May 3rd show, the Wildside News will get right into a 10-minute weekly global conference featuring the views, opinions, thoughts, and observations of some of the world's leading naturalists, scientists, and activists. The Weekly Earth Summit will feature a regular panel of experts who shape the debate and influence the research that is so critical around the world. Each week, during our first segment, you will be brought up to date by our 10 experts, helping you to keep informed, current, and prepared to help in this global effort. The regular panel reflects a broad spectrum of thought, so critical now to help you formulate your own conclusions and actions based on research and action that is drawn from the data being collected by NASA, research coming from around the world on animal behavior, population studies, as well as the thoughts of the major environmental organizations, the faith-based community, students, and the provocative progressive ideas that challenge us all to think of bold new visions for our future. We are proud to announce the regular participation by the following Weekly Earth Summit regulars. Bringing years of professional experience from his years at NASA, working with the Pew Foundation on the oceans, directing the Scripps Institution of Oceanography, Dr. Charles Kennell is currently heading up UCSD's Environment and Sustainability Initiative. He chaired the National Academy of Science National Research Council Committee on Global Change Research from 1998 to 2001. Dr. Kennell's understanding of the complexities of the dynamics of our Earth is expressed in his wise, specific commentary that inspires even the highest members of the scientific community to take action. Joining us each week as well will be Dr. Robin D. Moore, who heads up the Amphibian Specialist Group with the internationally renowned Conservation International. Dr. Moore is actively involved in addressing specifically the tragic condition of amphibians around the world. His weekly efforts will help to unite a worldwide awareness and response network to move quickly to do what is necessary to stem the impending crash of this whole class of animals. Speaking up to foster the awareness that animals are complex, feeling, intelligent, responsive members of the living continuum is Dr. Mark Beckhoff, Professor Emeritus of Biology at the University of Colorado. He directs some of the world's most advanced studies in animal communication. He's authored many books on the emotional lives of animals. Along with Jane Goodall, he is co-founder of Ethologists for the Ethical Treatment of Animals and will unite his perspective along with the other panelists each week to provide a balanced vision of revisioning our future. Dr. Thomas Lovejoy brings to the weekly Earth Summit a unique mix of scientific acumen as a biologist who brilliantly defines the nature of nature. As president of the Heinz Center for Science, Economics, and the Environment, Dr. Lovejoy is central to the emerging shift in vision of globalization. He has been advisor to the World Bank, the United Nations, the World Wildlife Fund, and the Smithsonian Institution. Each week, his emerging vision will be shared with that of the other panelists. One of the strongest voices for the Earth has been Dave Foreman, who provided the stalwart spirit and voice to stand against the unjust taking of the legacy of the living from the world's natural treasury. He sees through much of the smoke and mirrors to find the truth, and he speaks it. He is a highly regarded author and founder of the Rewilding Institute that is dedicated to reconnecting the broken fabric of nature. We are proud to provide Dave Foreman his place at the podium each week to speak his truth on the weekly Earth Summit. Many in the environmental movement have been perplexed at the lack of a moral voice for the Earth. The faith-based communities, which turned to divine guidance, were uniquely silent on behalf of God's creation. Dr. Matthew Sleeth is on a quest for serving God and finds that in so doing, it is natural that the planet will be served as well. A powerful and gentle reason guides his inspiring words, which have awakened a sense of service to God's creation in an ecumenical turning of faith-based communities to join in saving the earth. His voice represents an integral part of the work yet to be done to save life on earth. Many of us have been active environmental and nature advocates for years, and we know that much of our struggle has been to preserve the wonders for future generations. College students represent that new emerging voice for the earth, and we will include young advocates from colleges across America to bring voice to their emerging voice on behalf of those yet to come. Each week, this amazing panel will talk to you in short, precise language that conveys quickly a sense of the state of the arc. The Weekly Earth Summit is the only such regular, globally available meeting of the minds that will keep the world united in this great opportunity to find our common ground through our common destiny. Because we feel that bringing the Weekly Earth Summit to the world each week is the most important mission of the Wildside News, we will bring this important message at the very beginning of each show, as most of us find our lives requiring an efficient use of time. Therefore, if nothing else, when you turn on the Wildside News each week, you will be immediately brought up to date with the most important 10 minutes on Earth. We also plan a programming change as we follow the weekly Earth Summit with the news, and then focus on one feature in our second segment. As we have for the past 3 years, we will continue to interview naturalists, authors, researchers, advocates, and people from across the nation as we go in-depth on one topic each week. So when you tune in next week, we launch our premier broadcast of the weekly Earth Summit. Join us at the table each week to hear what the world's best voices of the earth are saying. As we begin to head into summer and the rest of this year, we really cannot know what to expect. As with the recent disappearance of the honeybees, there are unknowable changes that we must now face. As weather becomes more unpredictable as species are challenged by unexpected disease and even the effects of rapidly expanding populations throughout the planet. You can know that each week you can come to the weekly Earth Summit to hear what our most versatile and circumspect minds advise. So we thank all of our listeners and look forward to a fresh new format that we are sure you will find invaluable in the years ahead. This is Sidney Wildsmith extending a very personal invitation to join our expanding global nature network as we launch the weekly Earth Summit beginning next week, May 3rd. And now, we get ready to take a wander around America and feel spring returning to our wondrous lands. Put on your hiking boots, pick up a couple of field guides, we're heading out. When your voice of the earth continues, here on the Wild Side News.
Melting polar ice was a dirty look. Shrinking glaciers, a nudge. Then dying coral reefs pushed us, hard. Rising ocean temperatures and extreme weather, an uppercut. Then record-breaking heat waves hit us right where it hurts. Has it occurred to anyone that maybe the Earth is trying to get our attention?
We can still reduce greenhouse gas pollution. To find out how, go to fightglobalwarming.com. Brought to you by Environmental Defense, the Robertson Foundation, and the Ad Council.
Welcome back to the Wild Side News. And now, Sidney Wildsmith.
Snap quiz. Ready? Name the state park closest to you. Okay, that was easy. And today we're heading to a bunch of state parks across America to get a sense of what's happening in our natural world as spring launches across America when your voice of the earth continues here on the Wild Side News. One of our greatest gifts that we too often take for granted are our state parks. Did you know that there are over 5,000 state parks across America, with over 12 million acres of land? Many of these parks contain some of the finest natural areas open to you and are often staffed with rangers and naturalists who know a lot about what's happening in their parks. I believe in state parks. I started my career as a naturalist in a state park, and I know the joys of working with the public as they come to relax, hike, overnight, and just have fun. Right now, state parks across America are all experiencing spring in their own ways. Today, we visit five state parks to see how spring is launching across America. It's great to get a sense of how big and diverse this land really is, and how nature finds its own unique expression and balance in each unique place. Today, we celebrate spring across America. We begin our journey by heading out into the wildlands of Montana to see what spring brings in Big Sky Country. Spring is in the air, and we're taking some time today to travel across the country and visit a lot of our state parks. We've certainly spent a lot of time on the Wild Side News covering the national parks, talking to a lot of the interpreters and chiefs of interpretation and park managers. But for every national park, I don't know what the number is, but there must be at least 20 state parks out there. This is an opportunity for you to hear what's happening across the nation and what's happening in state parks, which stretch from Maine to Florida and Washington to California and everywhere in between. So now we're going to head up to Montana and talk with Richard Hopkins, who is the park manager. Richard, welcome to the Wild Side News.
Thank you.
Well, first of all, give us a sense of where Elm Pishkan State Park is in Montana.
Well, Elm Pishkan is just 10 miles west of Great Falls on the road to Helena. We're the largest buffalo jump in North America, and our park is about 2,000 acres.
Now, what's a buffalo jump?
A buffalo jump is where the first peoples actually ran entire herds of buffalo off of a cliff. The cliff is over a mile long at our park, and it was used from 900 to 1500. So this is prehistory. Everyone that came to the park and used it walked here, so this was prior to the horse.
Very interesting. I've certainly with that feature, but I never knew of them as buffalo jumps. That's a term that's probably been around for a while, but slipped by me. Now, are you a mountain park, or are you more in the lowlands?
We're actually close to the mountains, but we're still on the plains. We're almost where the plains meet the mountains.
Gotcha. That's going to be a beautiful landscape up there, then.
Yes, it's at our park. You can see to the Rocky Mountain front, to the west, and then to the south. You look to the Big Belts, to the east, you see the Little Belts, and then the Highwood Mountains is another range, and so they've all got snow on them right now, and it is beautiful.
How long have you been with the park?
I've been here about 2.5 years.
Uh-huh. And now state parks is different than national parks. National parks, you'll find people moving around to different parks. Has this been your career?
No, sir. Actually, I retired from the federal government, the Bureau of Land Management in Great Falls, and I'd worked a lot with the tribes because our state park is a sacred site for the tribes of Montana and Idaho. They still come here and perform ceremonies. We encourage that because it is their sacred site. So that's one of the reasons why we are a park. We wanted to preserve the site itself because of the large amounts of buffalo bones and history of tribal use here.
Do you have a website for your park?
It's actually come to mt.gov, and then parks, and then Om Pishkan.
Well, I encourage people to take a look at that website and find out more about the park, but now we're just going to go a little bit personal, Richard, and I'm curious, because you live at the park, or you spend a lot of time at your park, what's happening in terms of the natural elements today?
Well, today, we get a lot of wind at the park, so most days are windy, but we're starting to green up here. We've had a lot of rain this past week, over 1.5 inches. The grasses are starting to green up, but the flowers that are early have not even started to bloom yet, but we do have wild onion, the wild mustard, and the lupines that are sprouting somewhat, but nothing in bloom yet as far as they're concerned. But we have a large population of migratory birds that come into the area. Our burrowing owls are back. They've been here for the last 4 years, three nesting pairs to raise their young, and they live in the prairie dog town up on top. Our prairie dog town is probably 82 acres in size, so it's a pretty good size prairie dog town. Now, the other things that's happening, the other birds that are coming in, of course, the snowy owls here year-round, and the short-eared owls, strangely enough, actually spent the winter here. That's the first time they've done that. They usually migrate out. And we've got a nesting pair of golden eagles, and it looks like they're working on the nest right now. So it looks like they're going to raise some young this year.
Now, your snowy owls, do they change to their winter coats in your area there?
Yes, they do. The same way with we have the snowshoe hare, same thing. Of course, we have a lot of cottontail rabbits, but the main things, like you say, the snowy owl and the snowshoe hare, they change colors, and it's kind of interesting to see.
Of course, everybody's talking about climate change. Do you sense any sort of change in this particular spring?
Yes, we do, and we think that's why the short-eared owl stayed at the park this year, because normally they migrate out, so that was kind of a surprise to us.
They would head south because the winters were too severe.
Yes, sir.
Mm-hmm. Very interesting. Well, that's a worthwhile observation.
Yep. And we have big game animals that are here at the park. We have a herd of antelope that's about 100 in size. We have mule deer. There's probably a herd of two different herds, maybe 17 in total. Bobcat, we have probably two families of bobcat here. We have our yellow-bellied marmots. They're coming out now because of the warm days. The face of the cliff is about 50 feet high that they ran the buffalo off of. All beneath that cliff is denning for your snakes. So we have a lot of rattlesnakes here, plus bull snakes and yellow-bellied racers, and they will probably be out in another week. They're right now, they're just out on warm days like today, sunning at the mouth of the dens and so on.
So that's obviously something that you have to be aware of in the spring. I'm very familiar with that, having spent time in New Mexico. The rattlers will pretty much den up or get under protected areas when it gets cold. But at the moment that it starts to warm up, they're out there sunning, and you have to suddenly start to really pay attention where you're walking.
Yes, you sure do.
Yeah. And I'm curious about the snowy owls and do they overwinter there?
Yes, sir, they do.
And do they stay active, or do they tend to somewhat hibernate?
They stay active because we've got a good population of cottontail rabbit in the park, and they feed on those. We've got a lot of sharp-tailed grouse and Hungarian partridge in the park. They feed on those. The prairie dogs come out on warm days, and they feed on those. So they're here year-round, and we find the bones underneath some of our eaves here at the visitor center of the whatever they had for dinner the night before.
We're talking with Richard Hopkins, who's the park manager at is it Pishkin?
It's a Blackfoot word that means corral, and it's pronounced Pishkin.
Oh, that's interesting. Then the word itself probably was used in the corralling of the animals.
Yes, and see, that's not even correct, but some of the bloods that come down from Canada that are members of the Blackfoot tribe, they say it's actually pronounced Pishkan. And Pishkan, they say, means deep kettle of blood. And 2 years ago, we found what they describe as the deep kettle of blood eroding out of some of the banks of one of the coulees. And the deep kettle of blood was actually a hole dug into the ground, probably 18 inches and probably 2 feet in diameter. It was lined with rocks. And they filled that hole with grass and sticks and buffalo chips when they were using it to fire that, to heat those rocks. Then they take a buffalo hide with the blood, the fat, and the bone marrow, and they'd make a blood pudding.
Hmm.
And that's what they used later to make their pemmican cakes, which was the high protein bar of the day that they were really after.
Hmm. Interesting history. Richard, now, of all the reasons to be at a park, Alm Pishkin Park, what's your favorite?
Well, probably right now just the sound of the meadowlarks. We have an abundance of meadowlarks. People love to come out here and just sit and listen to the meadowlarks. It sounds just like a wildlife tape. They're just beautiful.
The meadowlarks in the spring, you're absolutely... You know, I've been away from the meadowlarks for a while, and as soon as you mentioned that, my whole spirit lifted because that it's possibly one of the most colorful, strong, vibrant songs. It's just so filled with life.
Yes, and you know, there's a history from the tribe, since this is their sacred site. Even though the Sioux didn't use this particular jump, but they were in Montana, that it was the meadowlark that Chief Sitting Bull, he had the talent to communicate with the birds, and in all of their history about Sitting Bull, it was the meadowlark that he communicated with mostly. Meadowlark saved his life at one time, saved him from a grizzly bear, told him to lay still, and he did so. Survived.
Well, those are realms that personally I wish I knew a lot more about. I know that I love to communicate with animals, and I respect them as beings myself. Do you expect more snow coming in yet throughout the spring?
Probably a couple of more weeks we could have some more snow, because this is the time of year when you start getting rain showers, and then the temperature drops and into the 31, 32 degrees, and you start getting snow. So we'll still get a wet snow, and it'll last maybe overnight or part of the morning. So, yeah, we'll still have some of that. And one of the other interesting birds that are here in the park, that it has a beautiful sound, and you see most of them on top of the buffalo jump, is the long-billed curlew. If you've never heard a curlew, they make a beautiful sound, too. That's something people come out here just to see and to listen to. Because they migrate on through once it dries up a little and the spring rains are gone, then they'll move a little further north.
Now, do you have any open water in your park?
We have three reservoirs, is all, and they're man-made dams. But by those, you know, we have the American Avocets, and then, of course, later on, and possibly happening right now, we have the small bats, and there's plenty of those around the park, because of the caves and things, because of the cliff. And so you can go out at night and just shine a light on these ponds, and they're just bats all over the place. So it's kind of fun.
How big is your park?
About 2,000 acres.
Uh-huh. And is it primarily a prairie park, or is it mixed?
It's primarily a prairie park. The visitor center, it's in the low spot of the park, and to the top of the jump, we have a hiking trail that's about 3 miles round trip, and you gain about 650 feet in elevation. But otherwise, it's pretty flat.
And can people camp at your park?
No, sir. It's a day-use park only. Because of the scenic vista and the significance of the sacredness of the site, we have pictographs and petroglyphs here, so we do not have camping at this time. We really don't have any place right now where we could accommodate that, and people haven't really been that interested because there are the significant number of rattlesnakes.
Yes, that definitely changes the your willingness to spend time, particularly on the ground.
You mentioned what else is happening in the spring here. We have ringneck pheasant. Of course, they're an introduced species, but they are actually mating at this time, so they are doing some of their mating rituals. We have sharp-tailed grouse that do their dancing. We have that going on in the park.
Oh, that's an exciting thing to see.
Yeah, it's kind of fun. And so these opportunities, you know, are here and happening right now.
It sounds, because you're a prairie park, that a lot of these birds, therefore, are on the ground as they're passing through, particularly the migrants. And so it must be an extraordinary birding park.
Yes, it is. It's really an excellent place. We have a lot of Audubon people come out here and just do the bird watching.
Well, Richard Hopkins at Alm Pishkan State Park in Montana, I want to thank you so much, and enjoy the rest of your spring.
Sure, and if, you know, there's 50 other parks in Montana, so and they range from east to west, so there's a lot of things for people to do in the state parks in Montana.
Our spring tour now continues as we visit the state park that inspired me to become a naturalist. Well, as we continue our journey across the United States, visiting state parks and the naturalists, and learning what's happening literally in all of these areas as spring emerges, I'm really thrilled to be able to head back to Minnesota, which is where I'm from, and as well to my absolute all-time favorite park, because that's where I was inspired to become a naturalist by a legendary naturalist who I understand is still talking about nature, Ben Thoma, and that's Itasca State Park, the headwaters of the Mississippi River. And I'd like to welcome to the show Connie Cox, who's the naturalist at Itasca State Park. Connie, welcome to the Wild Side News.
Well, thank you very much for having me on today.
Well, it's good to hear a little bit of Minnesotanese in your voice. I'm certainly familiar with Itasca State Park. It's a wonderful park, so you get a chance to go out every day and find out what's going on, and this time of the year things are really changing quickly in Minnesota. Talk about what's coming on.
Oh, yes. Right now, exploring Itasca is a wonderful time of year because spring is just arriving in our area. Just yesterday, the ice finally melted off of the surface of Lake Itasca, and with that, the array of waterfowl that have returned to the open water, it's wonderful, again, to hear the common loon, which is our state bird, as it yodels across the lake and setting up its nesting territory. Bald eagles and the osprey have returned, hunting the open water for fish and setting up their nesting areas. And the other wonderful thing is the buds are now starting to swell on all of the trees. For example, the aspens, their flowers are extending, and the catkins are elongating, and we're just starting to get a flush of green in different parts of the woods. So after a long winter of just seeing what we say is brown or white or gray, it's wonderful to be getting the color of flowers coming back, and of the waterfowl, the birds, and just seeing other animal activity as spring is finally coming to the northern parts of the state.
Now, Itasca is known for Lake Itasca, which is the headwaters of the Mississippi. And go ahead and give me that number. How many miles is it from the headwaters town to the Gulf?
All right. Itasca is the starting place for the mighty Mississippi River, and the river itself will journey about 2,450 miles to the Gulf of Mexico. However, that number changes every year or two or three as we have different flooding. So on our on our historic post at the headwaters, it says 2,552, and it measured that at one time, but it can change. And it's a wonderful spot for people to come out and visit and see this mighty river.
It's been a long time since I've been to Itasca. When I was there, pretty much there were just some rocks across the river. How is that crossing now? It's pretty much the same?
It's pretty much the same. That's the beauty of Itasca State Park. The park itself is over 32,000 acres in size. It was created, just to let the visitors know, that it was created in 1891. And at that time, very little development had occurred in Itasca. And so when people visit today, they're still seeing a pristine forest that was not really changed by homesteading. There had been some logging in the park, in small parts of it, but visitors can come and see big virgin pine stands, old-growth timber. They can also come and walk across the headwaters of the Mississippi, where it's just a small, narrow river. It usually is no deeper than mid-shin deep. And that's like the river when Henry Rowe Schoolcraft discovered it in 1832. It still looks the same.
You also are blessed with a gorgeous lodge. I just have these recollections of the grand timbers and the deep-colored woods. Tell us about the Itasca Lodge.
Oh, that's a wonderful thing about Itasca as well, as we do have the historic Douglas Lodge. It was constructed in 1905, so we celebrated our centennial on the lodge just a few years ago. And people can come and visit. They can have stay in one of the rooms at the lodge, and it has some of the original furnishings that have been meticulously restored. There's a full-service restaurant in the lodge as well, so you could have breakfast, lunch, or dinner. And the dining room and some of the rooms face out over Lake Itasca. And it's just a wonderful experience. And being up in the North Woods of Minnesota, oftentimes you don't even need to use the air conditioning because the natural cooling of Lake Itasca, just it's a wonderful retreat from the heat of summer. And as well as the lodge, there are numerous log cabins along the lakeshore as well that were constructed in the 1920s and 1930s. And people can just come and experience a historic feeling, kind of stepping back in time and stepping away from the race of today and experience what relaxation was like for many people, you know, 75 years ago.
A lot of people are talking about global warming and climate change, and some people are suggesting that the seasons seem to be changing, the spring coming on earlier or later, depending on where you are. And how has your spring been so far in terms of its historical record?
This particular spring has been more normal in the sense of it's been a long, cool spring. We actually just had snow. We had about 4 inches of snow a week and a half ago, and you could still go ice fishing on Lake Itasca. However, at this time of year, we do tend to get a lot of spring rains and some warm days with wind, and that did open the lake up a little more on the normal time schedule. But through Itasca's history, people have been recording when the ice would freeze over and cover up Lake Itasca, as well as when it would go out, or what we call ice out, when it would finally melt. And we have noticed a slight change in that the lake is freezing over a little later in the fall, and that sometimes it will open up possibly a week earlier than historic records. And so there is some recording of example, the ice forming on the lake, but right now, this particular year, we are following a normal spring pattern.
Now, for you as a naturalist, I know there's a wealth of animal life. It really does come alive. It's so happy to see the warmer days. Any stories this year that have stood out for you in terms of what some of those creatures are doing?
I just spoke with some people who were out walking one of our trails, and a fisher went running past them. A lot of the wildlife is very active now as they're establishing either their breeding territory or as they are raising their young. And, for example, our wolf pack has become very quiet in the park because now is the time that they would be having their young. But now is also a fun time because, for example, the bigger mammals such as the black bear are starting to come out of their dens. And with that, as the sows come out with their cubs, we get to start seeing that newness of life as we see the young cubs, as we see some of the other animals as they're bringing their young out as well. So just a lot of different stories with people talking about the antics of the bald eagles as they're setting up their nesting territory, and just the increase in bird songs as they also establish their territories. There's just not one story you can tell because, as you said, Itasca just has an incredible array of wildlife, and it's just too hard to pick one wonderful story.
That's one thing I missed that I think is unique about that area. It's a healthy environment there. A lot of these forests have been pretty much protected and left intact, and therefore the populations and the mix of the creatures is very, very diverse and healthy. Give us a little kind of an overview of some of the creatures that people might see on a walk through the woods at this time of the year.
Itasca actually is very wonderful, like you mentioned, the diversity because of the rather undeveloped landscape that we have. But Itasca is also very interesting because we're on the confluence of three biomes. We're very close to the prairie biome, the hardwood belt, and also the conifer system. And so visitors coming out right now, especially in spring with the animal activity, you can see black-backed woodpeckers, which this is their southern region in Minnesota. You can see those birds being active, but oftentimes you can see indigo buntings and some other bird activity that's more typical of on a prairie or hardwood system. We also have even just our spring flowers that come up. We have some of our spring flowers that are very typical found in a conifer boreal system, but then in some areas of the park we're noticing our spring flowers that are more prairie or hardwood based flowers. So it's again, and because of that undisturbed landscape, we get to enjoy a lot of that, as well as springtime is a wonderful time to start looking for the ferns as they begin coming out and what we call the fiddlehead stage, and everybody's always anxious to see that. And for example, the goblin fern, which is a very rare fern in Minnesota, which we do have coming up within Itasca. And so every year people are out trying to track down their favorite flower to photograph or to look at.
You mentioned also something that not many parks can boast, and that is you talk about your wolf population.
The pack that we have within Itasca is one that they have been studying since the 1980s, with the wolf being put on the endangered species list and its protection. We have seen over the last 25 years the expansion of the wolf population that now within Itasca, this pack, which is about 7 members in the pack, they have been there for over 20 years working that area. But we're also noticing wolf packs that are forming beyond the boundaries of Itasca. And for those who may have traveled Minnesota, there is even a wolf pack as far as Little Falls, which is farther down on the Mississippi River in about the central part of the state. And that one resides at Camp Ripley. And so the wolf population has been expanding, and there's maybe different reasons for that, with more people planting forest land as they change over from agricultural land, and also just some of the public awareness of the wolf and the appreciation that people do have for the wolf, especially in Minnesota. A lot of people enjoy that because to us it's a symbol of that pristine wilderness of which we are proud of within in our land here in Minnesota.
Have you had a chance to hear your local wolf pack?
Yes, I have. It's a wonderful experience. If you want to, it's hard to explain. It's hard to describe. But when you hear one calling, if it's an adult and it vibrates inside your chest cavity and it causes you to get goosebumps on your goosebumps because you realize this animal, the representation of this animal that has been here for thousands of years. And it's also fun if in the late summer you can hear the young wolf pups as they're learning to howl. I kind of say they sound like prepubescent teenagers. As our voices crack when we're hitting puberty, that's what the young wolf pups sound like as they're trying to learn to howl like an adult. It's just a wonderful experience, and nothing can beat when you actually get to see one. as it's traveling, which, again, a person has to go out into those more remote areas, and sometimes you are given the opportunity to enjoy seeing one.
Well, Connie, you're an extremely lucky person to be up at Itasca as the naturalist there. Don't ever give that up unless there's no alternative. I want to thank Connie Cox, who's the interpretive naturalist at Itasca State Park, for bringing us up to date on what's happening in one of the, I think, one of the nation's finest state parks. Connie, thanks so much.
Well, thank you, Sydney, and you have a wonderful day, and I hope you can come back out and visit us at Itasca real soon.
While we're in the North Country, we now head a bit west and close up to the border of Canada as we explore the March of Spring into North Dakota. We now continue our discussion and exploration of what's happening in our state parks across the United States. And now we take off and head into the North Country, up into North Dakota, to Icelandic State Park. Joining us now is Dennis Clark. Dennis, welcome to the Wild Side News.
Thank you.
First of all, Dennis, what's your role at the park?
My title is park ranger. I'm actually serving the role of an assistant park manager.
How long have you been in this position?
Actually, 2 years, although I did work here in the early 90s for about 3 years in the same position.
Is your background in parks, and you find yourself at this park, or is this a new career for you?
Actually, I kind of got into parks through the back door. I taught school for a number of years and started working in parks in the summers and worked into a second career.
Well, I'm sure everybody's wondering, why is the park named Icelandic State
that's
Park?
That's a good question. It's called that because in this particular part of North Dakota, a lot of Icelandic people settled here, and part of the park property was donated to the state of North Dakota by an Icelandic family. It includes North Dakota's first state nature preserve, and a homestead, a home and barn are still on the site.
So did they come to this area because it resembled conditions back in Iceland? Do you know the history?
That is somewhat true, yes. They passed up some of the most fertile farmland in North Dakota and ended up in a little more hilly country, and it probably did remind them a little bit more of what they were used to.
Yeah, it kind of reminds me of some of my ancestors. I'm of at least partially Norwegian Scandinavian background, and they settled in Minnesota. It was one of the coldest places, along with North Dakota, Continental 48. First of all, why don't you give us a little overview of your park? Tell me what, when you look out, what are you looking at?
Well, we're along the Tongue River, which is a small river in North Dakota, and the park consists of that natural area with a nature preserve, and there's hiking trails down in a wooded river bottom forest environment. We also have a man-made lake that is the other feature of the park where our campgrounds are located. There's some natural forest in the campground, and a lot of trees have been planted in the campground. Pines and evergreens grow well here. We have a really sandy soil, so kind of a mixture, and it's a beautiful park and a beautiful area.
How big is the park?
A little under 1,000 acres.
My quest today is to find out, to get a sense of what's happening across the nation as spring launches here. What are you noticing in terms of birds, the flowers, whatever it is that's happening in Icelandic State Park?
I was just out here a little while ago and noticed we have kind of an early flower, a sign of spring in North Dakota in this part of the state. That would be the crocus or pasque flower. And we do some controlled burns in the park for improving the native grasses, and you can see those really well in those areas. And, of course, there's quite a few birds are back. A lot of our summer birds, are gradually returning. I've seen birds like flickers and meadowlarks and have some juncos and finches at my feeder. And there are some water birds, some ducks and so forth, returning. Great blue herons are here.
Now, some people, of course, are suggesting that the climate seems to be changing, the weather patterns are changing. How has your spring been in relationship to previous springs?
Well, in February, we'd have had a hard time convincing us, probably, of global warming.
Yeah.
We had a really bitter cold stretch in February, and I would say our spring was, a little bit later in some respects, maybe partially due to that. But with the last couple of weeks, we've been having beautiful nice weather, so it feels and looks like spring.
Give me a little description of the kind of the mix between open lands and then forested zones.
We're kind of a little bit similar to northwestern Minnesota. There are some kind of open areas, and and right in this area, and then there are some aspen forest lands, and so it's kind of a mixture. Right where the park is located, if you're traveling the highway, you know, you would go through a fairly forested area, and then it starts to open up again. We're near the shoreline of the glacial Lake Agassiz, and when you go up that escarpment, there's a, you know, that's heavily forested, and then you open up to the west on more open prairie land.
Mm-hmm. So in terms of the native wildlife, do you see any sort of evidence of spring?
The white-tailed deer is very high in North Dakota in recent years, and in the winter they tend to bunch up, and now they've been dispersing, so you don't see those large groups typically of deer that you see in the wintertime. So and of course the Canadian geese are back and things like that. So.
Now, in terms of the park itself, how do they recreate there?
The main focus of our park would be, especially in the summertime, would be weekend campers. And the lake is a big focus. We have a nice sandy swimming beach and boating on the lake and fishing to some extent, but a lot of water recreation and then camping. We have a number of weekends when our campground is full. We have over 160 campsites. And the camping here is a lot of repeat customers, a lot of camp with your friends and sit around the campfire at night and enjoy good company and that type of thing.
That's one of the great things about the state parks is that it very often really serves the local community. So I imagine that the bulk of your campers there are from the region there.
That's very typical, yes. We have the bulk probably from maybe 60 to 100-mile radius. We happen to be fairly close to the Canadian border, so about 40% of our campers are Canadians throughout the summer.
Mm-hmm. Now, do you have a website where people can learn more about the park?
Yes, we do. Our website is www.parkrec, that's P-A-R-K-R-E-C, .nd.gov.
Yeah, you've been there for a couple of years. What is your favorite aspect of Icelandic State Park?
You know, there's so many aspects of all of our state parks that just vary a little bit. The nature preserve in particular has some fens and really moist areas, some springs and seats and things like that. So it's a totally different environment. So that's very enjoyable. And then just the amount of trees in the area, a lot of North Dakota doesn't have the forested areas, so that gives it a nice aspect. The natural forest would be more oak, ash, American elm, which have kind of died off from disease, aspen, a little bit of birch, box elder, green ash.
So it's very much a deciduous forest. I was kind of imagining a pine zone, but I was trying to figure that out. So
yeah, that would be the difference from most of, I guess I compare this to northern Minnesota, that where the pines are, you know, grow naturally. Here it's more of a deciduous forest.
Totally different zone then, yeah. So you've got yourself a beautiful wood. So therefore, I imagine there's quite a display of undergrowth, wildflowers and things that are bursting out about now.
Pretty much poised to start out.
Poised to start out, yeah. I have to remember, you're way up there.
Yeah.
I know that when I was in Minnesota, if you knocked me out for a month or so and dropped me in the middle of one of the parks there, I could tell you almost to the week what week it was, because the flowers came in this wonderful succession, and you'd look around, you'd find the mix, and you'd pretty much know what time of the year it was there. If people want to find the park, give them some landmarks, some routes that can get them there.
Most people probably... if they're looking at the interstate highway system, I-29 is on the eastern edge of North Dakota, runs north and south, and we're west of I-29 on Highway 5, and more closely 5 miles west of the town of Cavalier, North Dakota.
What's your largest big city?
We're about 80 miles from Grand Forks, North Dakota.
That's sacred country up there.
Yeah.
We want to thank Dennis Clark. He's the park ranger at Icelandic State Park in North Dakota. Dennis, thanks so much for adding your voice here on the Wild Side News.
You bet. Thank you. Have a good day.
I'm getting a catcher's mitt.
I'm getting ice skates.
I'm getting a jigsaw puzzle.
I'm getting dying coral reefs.
A blue bicycle.
A walkie-talkie.
I'm getting a severe drought.
Cool black skateboard.
I'm getting melted ice caps.
A killer heat wave.
A shrinking glacier.
I'm getting a devastating flood.
Adults are generous. We're even giving kids global warming. But it's not too late. We can still reduce greenhouse gas pollution. Go to fightglobalwarming.com. Brought to you by Environmental Defense, the Robertson Foundation, and the Ad Council.
Welcome back to the Wild Side News. And now, Sydney Wildsmith.
In just a moment, our celebration of spring continues as we journey to the land made famous by Katrina along the bayous of the Gulf. And then we finish our journey in the big woods of South Carolina, when your voice of the earth continues here on the Wild Side News. Our journey and exploration of state parks across the United States this spring now takes us down to an area that not all that long ago was mainstream in the news, and this is in the New Orleans area. We're traveling to Bayou Saguenay State Park, which is in the New Orleans area, and now joining us to talk about what's happening in that park is Denise McKinney, who is the interpretive park ranger. Denise, welcome to the Wild Side News.
Hi, how are you doing?
Very, very good. How are you doing?
Oh, I'm doing great. It's a beautiful day today.
Tell me about what you do at Bayou Saguenay State Park.
Well, basically, I'm in charge of public programming. We have a lot of educational opportunities for our public, our schools, our Girl Scouts, Boy Scouts, anybody who wants to listen, basically. We talk about wetlands and anything to do with nature, the wildlife, the trees, the flowers. Anything like that. We just take the opportunities to educate the public about some of these areas that haven't been torn down and houses built on, and just what we can do to help these animals and help this habitat, support it.
Well, you're a very lucky person. I miss my days as a field naturalist and interpreter. You get to go out every day and talk with people, and so therefore you have the opportunity to see what's going on. Tell us what you're noticing now that it's spring in Bayou Saguenay State Park that you think people would like to know about.
Well, right now, we're seeing a lot of flowers coming up. Of course, the Louisiana iris, which everybody loves to come and see, are coming out. We're seeing lots and lots of birds right now. I think the northern storms are keeping them here. We're seeing a lot of visiting birds, a lot of native birds, especially a lot of shorebirds, a lot of little songbirds. I'm just having a wonderful time with the birding here, so I'm going to do a lot of programs with birding. It is a little devastated because of all the tree damage. We lost thousands and thousands of trees, so it's going to take a while for all that to grow back. And I'm afraid it's going to give some of these Chinese tallow, which is an introduced species tree, a foothold, which is not a good thing, really. They're very fast-growing, very aggressive, and they take up some of the spots of all these nice cypress trees that we have out here and these beautiful live oaks.
Well, bayou is such a beautiful word, but a lot of people don't really quite grasp what a bayou is. Why don't you give us that interpretation?
Well, a lot of these bayous are basically the wetland areas, and these wetlands, there's all kinds of canals and waterways for fishing, and it's places where fish can come in, they spawn, there's places where shrimp come in. This is a native area where a lot of animals can come in and reproduce, and they're safe and protected by the marshes and the vegetation and the growth, and they have a better survival before they go out into the open areas. A lot of these canals are used by fishermen on a regular basis. A lot of boaters go out there. It used to be the only way of trappers and hunters to go back and forth before the main roads came in and the railroad system. And a lot of people used to get lost out here, and you'd have guides that would have to bring you through this area, and they'd bring boats back and forth just for these hunters. And so we have a lot of these wetlands over here. The wetlands slow up the storms that are coming inland and tearing down things. They collect some of the silt that's brought on by the waterways as they come rushing through. So they really protect us in a lot of ways.
Talk a little bit about the trees. So this is these are waterways that make their way and wend their way through. It's almost like a wetland forest, isn't it?
Oh, exactly. And the cypress trees, it's not as many cypress trees as they used to be. They're very slow growing, but they're very adapted to this wetland. And we just need to save the cypress tree. We need to get more cypress trees planted. We need to stop deforestating, getting rid of all these trees. We really need to keep them. They keep this land together. They keep all the brush and all the other stuff together. They keep all this as solid land. And the more and more these big trees leave, the more the land gets washed away.
Now, because it's spring, I'm just curious, what kind of changes happen in an area like that that are different that may happen, for example, in a more northern climate?
Well, luckily in Louisiana, we can have a lot of trees here that stay green all year long, especially like what they call live oaks. It's because they're green all year long. They do lose leaves, but they don't lose them all at once, like a lot of the northern trees. So a lot of these trees will remain green during the winter. So a lot of people come down here and they're just overwhelmed by all the green in the middle of the winter. It doesn't get nearly as cold here. You'll notice that a lot of our animal species, for instance, are smaller because they don't need to have that body mass to keep warm. So like a lot of the raptors, the great horned owls, and even the raccoons and stuff are a lot smaller here than they are up north because they don't need to protect themselves from that freezing weather.
That's an observation I'd never heard before. That's very interesting. That they're literally that's interesting. For park visitors who are coming, what in terms of nature, what is it that they seem to be most attracted to right now?
Birds. Birds are the big thing right now. We have lots of wading and shore birds, lots of egrets and herons. We actually have swallowtail kites around here. I've seen bald eagles. We have nesting pairs of bald eagles in the area. So birds are big time right now. And we're getting a lot of fruit on our plants right now. So the birds are eating those up. We have a lot of wildlife, possums, raccoons, coyote. I've even heard this bobcat out here yet. I haven't seen them yet. I've only been here a couple of months. But I have seen the coyote, this raccoon, like I said, armadillo, plenty of armadillos. All of those seem to survive the storm pretty well. Mm-hmm. A lot of reptiles right now. They're coming out. It's nice warm days. They're sunning.
Now, what kind of reptiles do you have in that area, in such a wet area?
Oh, all the major water snakes. The cottonmouth is our most venomous, probably, water snake, and probably the most aggressive. Everything else, we have brown-banded water snakes, broad-banded water snakes. There's just a large variety. We even have copperheads, which is, they'll hang around this area. They're not so close to the water, but they are in this area. A lot of speckled king snakes, corn snakes. We have a big variety of reptiles here.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of turtles, snapping turtles, common snappers, alligator snappers, red-eared sliders. There's a large variety of turtles. We have nutria, which is an introduced species, South American species. It's a large rodent. They were brought in for the fur trade, actually, but I don't think it really took off very well. Even though the fur is a wonderful product, I think people just couldn't get over the idea of fur from a rat, per se. So
rat fur.
They are a problem, though. They do dig up canals and waterways that we depend on to keep the water out of New Orleans. So they are a constant problem there.
The image that you create is that it's really teeming with life.
It is. It's a very busy area. You have to be very observant, because things can blend right in these woods. Even sitting right in front of you on a log, right on the water's edge, maybe a gator or a snake or something, and you may not even notice it right away until it decides to move.
Mm-hmm.
But there are a lot of gators here. And, hatchlings all the way up, 13, 14 feet sometimes. So we have them everywhere.
Are you outside right now?
Yes, I am.
Uh-huh. Okay. Also, you You've been at this park for only a couple of months, but that's because you moved over from the Audubon Science Institute, which is associated with New Orleans. Give us an update on what's happened, because there were so many stories coming out of particularly the zoo and the aquarium in terms of having to transfer animals, and it's a pretty scary moment. Tell us how things are progressing.
Well, the Audubon Nature Institute, I have been working there for nearly 20 years, and I worked at the zoo. The Nature Institute is a big group of facilities. They have a breeding facilities for endangered species. They have a nature center. They have an aquarium, IMAX theater. They have some green space downtown New Orleans on the waterfront. So we have a lot of facilities. They had a lot of facilities. We did very well at the zoo when it comes to the animals. We had to remove the sea lions after the storm because of water quality issues, because the electricity was down for so long. So they're taking that opportunity to renovate the pool while they're gone. But most of our other animals stayed. We have staff that stayed on grounds. The biggest deal for us with the hurricane was trees. We lost lots and lots of trees, just like a lot of New Orleans, and especially in the east, lots of trees. So it's going to take many years for all those big mature trees to come back. The animals did very well. The aquarium didn't fare as well because of life support systems. We were without electricity for long term. There were some problems with some generators. And, you know, it's a learning thing. Every time you have a storm like this, everybody learns what's best to do. So, you know, things are being improved. Anything we can do to improve has been done. We have a very knowledgeable staff that stayed on grounds, animal staff, mechanical staff, everything. So we did really well there.
On a more regional basis, you're a naturalist. You probably get a chance to hear stories and travel around that whole region. How's the region doing?
In my point of view, it was very depressing when we didn't have as much greenery, because I stayed for the hurricane, and right after it was total silence. You couldn't hear a bug. You couldn't hear a bird. Everything was totally brown. You know, everything had turned brown from all the leaves being ripped off the trees, and it took a while for all that green to come back. And when the green started coming back, that really changed the spirits, at least for me. You know, anybody that works outside and they start seeing green, it's new life, you know, because they expected a lot of this stuff to die, you know, with the influx of the salt water and, you know, all the chemicals and stuff. And, you know, it's really, really hardy. If it wasn't for the trees breaking, it's doing fairly well. I mean, we're still losing trees. I mean, every day you might find another tree fallen just from the damage, but it is coming back. It's just going to take a very long time. And I think now with all these dead trees, you're going to have a lot more rotting wood, a lot more nest cavities. You know, you can look positive, too. You have a lot more nest cavities, a lot more bugs and insects eating that wood, you know, things that eat wood, you know, some of the beetles and things, and their larvae depend on that. A lot of that is going to bring birds in, you know, because if there's more bugs, there's more birds. If there's more nest cavities, there's more birds, you know, places for these animals to hide. So now that it's starting to turn green, it's coming back. You know, the animals are going to come back. They're coming back very well. I'm really surprised at the number of birds I've been seeing, because I was a little concerned about them not having enough food, you know, once they got here. And the residents seem to fare well, too. I think they knew to get away and come back. So it seems like it's doing okay. It could have been worse.
That's a terrific update. I'll let you get back to the joys of being a naturalist. I want to thank you, Denise McKinney, the interpretive park ranger at Bayou Cygnet State Park in Louisiana. Thanks so much for adding your voice here on the Wild Side News.
All right. Thank you very much for calling.
Okay. Thanks. Now we finish our journey back east as we head into the wild country of the Mountain Bridge Wilderness Area that is part of the South Carolina State Park System. State parks are really a gift to all of us. They are in every state in the nation, and sometimes it's a little difficult to get out to the grand parks, the national parks, but literally in our backyards and in our communities, we're blessed to have all of these terrific state parks, and that's what we're really focusing on today. We're now heading off to South Carolina and the Mountain Bridge Wilderness Area and talking with Tim Lee, park naturalist. Tim, welcome to the Wild Side News.
Oh, thank you.
Well, Tim, first of all, you work with the Mountain Bridge Wilderness Area. That's quite an extensive zone and actually covers a variety of different state parks.
That's correct. The Mountain Bridge Wilderness Area, which is located at the northwestern corner of South Carolina, consists of Caesar's Head Natural Area, Jones Gap State Natural Area, and Wildcat Wayside State Natural Area. Combined area of about 11,000 acres.
That's big, and it's also quite a varied area.
Yes, it is. Everything from topography here at just over 1,000 feet above mean sea level to over 3,500 feet above sea level.
Mostly treed, or what's the mixture?
Predominantly forested area. There are seven different types of forest communities here, including oak, hickory forest, and a forest type that's a little bit more rare here in the eastern United States. It's called a mountain cove forest, which is really known for its species richness or its diversity. So there's really no one plant that identifies it, but it's really more that species richness. Beautiful areas.
When people come out to your park, what are they most likely to notice because it's spring? What's going to really stand out for them?
Well, right now, probably one of the things that stands out most in the spring here is going to be our spring wildflowers, the spring ephemerals. There are over 600 different plant species in the park. Many of them are flowering. And at this time of year, there's just a variety of colors, shapes, and patterns that really catches the visitor's eye. And as well, migratory songbirds. A lot of the migratory songbirds, like black-throated blue warblers, Louisiana water thrush, hooded warblers, many of those spring migrants are coming back. So the forest is kind of filled with song right now.
It's rather interesting, as I'm talking to different parks, the spring is coming in many fashions. In late April, where does that put you in the spring bloom? Where are you in that emergence of spring?
We're a little past halfway here at the lower elevations, but remember, you know, here in the Mountain Bridge at 1,100 feet above sea level, a lot of things have bloomed out, and we're probably about halfway through the blooming season. But by the time you get to the higher elevations in the wilderness area, above 3,000 feet at Caesar's Head, we're a little bit more delayed. We're about a 2-week difference in bloom time from the base of the mountain to the top of the mountain. So spring's kind of moving its way up the mountain.
What stands out in your area in terms of some wildflowers?
Gosh, I'm probably pretty biased, but some of the wildflowers that are the showiest right now, the brightest colors, interesting patterns, are a lot of the trilliums, Catesby trilliums, Bassie's trilliums, Wake Robin trilliums, and then several other species of flowering shrubs or bushes, if you would. Things like our mountain laurels and rhododendrons, both Carolina or shortleaf rhododendrons, are blooming, and the rose bay will be starting to bloom in a couple of weeks. But I would say the mountain laurels, Carolina rhododendrons, the trilliums are probably the most showy right now.
Now, I know the trilliums in various parts of the country come in different colors. Is that the case in your area as well?
It is, very much so. The Catesby trillium starts out white, fades to a pink. The Bassie's trillium is a deep burgundy, and occasionally you'll get white ones. And the mountain sweet Betsy, or the Doce trillium, you can have yellow coloration to deep purples.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk a little bit about your wildlife and what you're noticing in terms of their welcoming the new spring.
A lot of activity with the birds once again. Birds carrying nesting material, but some of them actually already have young. They're carrying food back to their nests. And many of them are you know, really starting in there early in that breeding season. So there's a lot of song out there. A lot of the males singing and establishing territory. Animals are becoming a little bit more active in terms of we're seeing a lot more signs of snakes. We're seeing things like garter snakes, corn snakes. We did see our first timber rattlesnake of the season a couple days ago.
Keep your eyes open, right?
Keep your eyes open. They are starting to move around a little bit. So the wildlife is definitely becoming active out there.
Obviously, you have lots of bear.
We do have black bear here in the park. The estimated population on black bear here in the mountains of South Carolina is about 900 bear. Uh-huh. Fairly conservative, but they are starting to move around a little bit. We're starting to see some signs.
And I imagine cougar and bear, bobcat as well?
We do still have bobcat in the state of South Carolina. However, there has not been a documented mountain lion and or cougar report in the state of South Carolina that has been documented since actually for about 3 decades now, so
yeah.
Probably an animal that's now missing from our forest.
Okay, well, this is the stuff we need to know, because some areas they're talking about how they're hearing them, you know, and
yeah, sure.
It's such a terrific diversity. Give us a little bit of history for you as a naturalist. How long have you been with the park system?
I've been with the park system, actually I've been here at the Mountain Bridge my entire career so far with the Park Service. I've been here for just a little over 7 years. prior to that, I was a naturalist just one valley away over in the state of North Carolina in the headwaters of the Green River for a private organization. So I've been a naturalist here in this part of South Carolina for just a little over 10 years now.
Now, in terms of the park complex that defines itself as Mountain Bridge Wilderness, let's talk a little bit about opportunities for people to visit, camping and things.
Most of the visitors who come to the Mountain Bridge, because it is a designated wilderness area, are people who are coming in to experience, have that natural experience, if you would. There's just over 55 miles of hiking trails, everything from easy to very strenuous, depending upon how long it is, how much elevation change you're going to make. So a lot of hiking opportunities. We do have primitive backpack camping sites that are spread throughout the Mountain Bridge. We have a wild population of trout in our stream systems here. There are three major streams that a lot of trout fishermen come out to fish in. And a lot of photography opportunities, once again, with those wildflowers, songbirds, and just those natural settings associated with the waterfalls and the streams. So a lot of hiking, backpacking, fishing, and photography takes place here.
You're so lucky to be a naturalist because you get to go out and be paid to wander through the wonder. I'm just curious now, when you have some time that's yours and you decide that you want to head to one of your favorite spots, what are you looking for?
Pretty much when I head out to my days off, a lot of times I actually head out here in the Mountain Bridge to go hiking, or there's several other areas that are close by to us, like the National Forest. I'm not too far from the Great Smoky Mountains either. So most of my time off is spent in the woods, either hiking or you know, river systems, kayaking. And so we're looking for that, like most of our visitors here, I'm looking for that natural experience out there.
We've been talking with Tim Lee, who's the park naturalist with the Mountain Bridge Wilderness Area in South Carolina. Tim, thanks so much for lending your voice here on the Wild Side News.
Thank you, sir.
As spring blooms across America, keep in mind that it is doing exactly the same thing in all natural areas in the Northern Hemisphere, just as it's heading into fall in the lands down under. This miracle of life is a gift, and as we take our efforts to deal with climate change onto the global stage, be sure to always reach a handout to help our natural world make that journey as well. This is our best hope now to begin to restore the wonder that has been so ravaged over the last 100 years. Keep listening to the Wild Side News, and next week, the Weekly Earth Summit, and we will make this journey together. This is Sidney Wildsmith saying adios. Until we meet again next week, or any time on the archives, when your voice of the earth continues, here on the Wild Side News.